Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On and Xander Kegg, licensed social worker, and Xander will do the introduction.
Thank you, On. Hello, everybody. Glad that you're back for another episode of the Umbrella Hour. Our guest today is Phil Illy, and I'm going to go ahead and read Phil's bio. I don't want to miss anything, so let's start. When Phil Illy found out he had a sexual orientation he'd never heard of, he set out to understand it. After learning enough to fill a book, he wrote Auto Heterosexual, Attracted to Being the Other Sex. Informed by more than a century of sexual research, Auto Heterosexual demystifies sexual orientation, gender, and transgenderism so that readers can better understand themselves and those they love. Before writing a book about his sexual orientation, Phil received degrees in physics and mechanical engineering before retiring to Portland, Oregon, where he became best known for his skill at handstand twerking and juggling hula hoops. Fun bio. Thank you so much. I'm so glad you're here. Welcome to the show, Phil. Phil, you've written a book. Let me just remind people of the title again, because it was in the early part of your bio. Auto-heterosexual: Attracted to Being the Other Sex. Now, this is something I would imagine most people have never heard of. Our listeners are across the United States, the UK, India, majority, and the rest of the world as an international radio show. Could you give us a description of what is auto-heterosexual? And let's just start there. What is it? And what did you find in your research on the topic? Maybe there's some other terms people might be more familiar with or even less familiar with that you can introduce them to.
Yeah. So auto-heterosexuality is basically sexual orientation can sometimes, instead of being directed outward, it can be directed inward inside of yourself, and it makes you want to become what you love. And when this happens with heterosexuality, it makes you attracted to being the other sex and embodying the other sex and any traits you associate with it. And this is more commonly in the scientific literature, in males, it's called autogynephilia, for love of self as woman. And when it's in females, it's called autoandrophilia, for love of self as man. And these two types of auto-heterosexuality are the primary drivers of cross-gender identity and gender dysphoria. And I felt compelled to write the book because it bothered me that I had been dealing with gender issues for years, and basically it had been covered up by the transgender movement, which made it so that it made it hard for me to understand my experience and understand what I was going through. I felt that was unfair. And so, yeah, I wrote this so that others like me could, when they do have this orientation and experience the types of thinking and feelings associated with it, so they could realize, oh, hey, that's what's going on. And then, you know, understand what it is. And then based on understanding their actual condition, decide, what do I want to do about it? You know, whether that's transvestism or transsexualism, like whatever avenue they take to embody the other sex to their satisfaction. I want them to do it knowing why they're doing it.
That's fascinating. When I first heard of this concept of auto-heterosexuality, it did make me think of the stories I had heard in my 20s. I'm now in my 50s, that from cross-dressers or transvestites, as was more common back then also. And with autogynephilia, that I'm very familiar with as far as how taboo that topic is, how it can just bringing it up in a shared space can get you in a lot of social trouble. Let's just put it that way.
So true.
Yeah. So the idea you have, it's like a sexual orientation that's turned inward. And you said that for people who have this sexual orientation, some of them are going to be going more in the transvestite or cross-dressing path, and some on the more transsexual, right? The medical, taking hormones, getting surgeries, changing your identity legally path. I'm wondering, is there a necessity then to differentiate between gender identity and sexual orientation when it comes to, is a gender identity a component of this sexual orientation, or is, because that's also viewed as an internal sense of self. So it's not an attraction to the sense of self, but it is the sense of self that I don't talk about having a gender identity myself, but I know that's a popular way of talking about things. If, let's say, as clinicians, right, to do a differential diagnosis, let's just put it in really clinical terms, how would one differentiate between auto-heterosexuality and a person who has a cross-sex or gender identification? Is there any difference, or is there a way to articulate that?
There's two known routes at arriving at a cross-gender identity, and one is traditionally called the homosexual ideology of transgenderism, and the other one that I talk about is auto-heterosexuality, where you're attracted to being the other sex. So there's basically two roads to the same place of having distress about your natal sex characteristics and wanting to be the other gender and live as that gender.
And where did you find, when you were doing your research, where did you find information about this concept, this identity, this pathway of auto-heterosexual? Is this a term that you came up with when doing your research, or were other people already using that term? It's the first I've ever heard of it, so I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, a colleague of mine, I'd seen him use it once or twice before, but... And when I Googled the term while I was writing the book to see if any other people had used it, there's a few like random forum posts throughout the years that people were trying to come up for other terms for autogynephilia, autoandrophilia. There's just a few random posts here and there, people being like, how about auto-heterosexual? For the most part, I'm going to be basically popularizing it, not the first to utter it, but I think it's a better word because, you know, as you mentioned, the word autogynephilia just already gets people triggered. And the fact that it has philia on the end, it doesn't have the best mouthfeel or the best like associations. Even though philia just means love, you know, people have a bad feeling about that sound. And I wanted a term that would include female autoandrophilia as the female counterpart to male autogynephilia, to treat them as they're not exactly equivalent because they'll be different in sex different ways. One will be more male typical, one will be more female typical in the psychology, but they're fundamentally both attraction to being the other sex. And so I wanted a term that treated the phenomenon equally and made it so you could articulate the two type model by just saying two different labels.
When did all this come about in your life?
You mean like in terms of me first having gender issues or learning about autogynephilia?
No, when you first started experiencing issues with gender.
It was actually later than is typical for people that are autogynephilic. It was kind of in my mid-20s once I started becoming friends with women. I'd made a I used to be like growing up, I was a gamer and it's a very male dominant environment. I didn't really have any females friends. And after I made a conscious decision to stop doing that nerd stuff. And after that happened, I started making female friends. And after that happened, I started sometimes being sad that I wasn't one of them, you know, when we were hanging out. And also sometimes had confusing gender experiences. Like there's one I wrote about briefly in the book where I had a really intense experience of gender euphoria that caught me by surprise at a concert. And it really confused me. And it made me wonder if I was transgender for like about a year or so until I successfully put those thoughts to the wayside. I was like, I know I'm not that, you know, as I thought at the time. And yeah, I just had a few signs and basically in my mid-20s based on various experiences. Then I learned about autogynephilia a few years ago when I was 31. And the concept, once I read, it really didn't seem like obviously that's what I had. But as I learned more about it, I became more and more certain that this was what I had, and it explained a lot.
So you talked about first becoming friends with women and then having this experience of feeling sad because you weren't one of them, like one of the gals, one of the group.
Exactly.
And I know that, you know, before I transitioned, I was part of the lesbian community. I was a very masculine woman. And there were always limits to being one of the guys, right? I worked in law enforcement. I was in the military. I was surrounded by male colleagues all the time, surrounded by male family members. And there were limits to how much I was really included. It was always clear to me. I was okay with that. I didn't have any actual problems being a masculine woman or being part of the lesbian or dyke community. That wasn't really a problem for me. But I did recognize that there never was going to be full integration into the world of men or the companionship of men solely in a non-sexual way, right? That there was going to be those barriers. And it sounds like that's something that you came up against, is you're not really going to be able to be one of the girls if you're not one of the girls, so to speak.
Right, exactly. And yeah. Like, yeah, feeling kind of like exiled from that social participation can hurt.
Yeah, because there's a different level or different type of communion or fellowship or camaraderie between women and between men and between men and women, right? In that way.
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned something about having a gender euphoric experience. Would you be willing to share with us what that was like?
That experience was, I was at a concert. To be specific, I was at a Lady Gaga concert. I was on mushrooms, as one does. And I felt there was just one point during the show, I felt like this like feminine soul build up inside of me. And like my body temperature increased, and it felt there was this tremendous feminine energy inside of me, and it was very confusing. But it also emotionally was a very positive feeling. And so it was very powerful and confusing. And years after that, occasionally I'd be able to tap into that feeling. It was never as strong as that first time, but I could tap into it to milder extents. And it's a very like comforting feeling of rightness in yourself that happens from it. And it's very reinforcing. So it makes you want to do the behaviors that led to it again. And it kind of just like, it's the carrot of gender feelings as opposed to the stick of gender dysphoria.
Yeah. It makes me think of people who are chasing being in flow, right? In flow mode or bliss, right? For people who are, or runners high, right? Always trying to capture some sort of probably endorphin related experience that's not so easy to recapture from that first time that we have that. You talked about a feminine soul, feminine energy. So let me just ask the question, and I'm not playing devil's advocate. I'm going to ask a question that I think people might intuitively ask, that I'm not particularly, I don't take this line of thinking, but I thought I'd ask you a question, something like, well, men can have feminine energy, right? That doesn't have anything to do with femaleness, right? Femininity is a characteristic that can be occupied by or experienced or felt by men and women. So if you're a male and you're experiencing a feminine side of your being in the form of an energy, many gay men might say they're tapped into their feminine energy, but they have no desire whatsoever to become a woman, maybe temporarily, right? If they're doing female impersonation or drag, but not anything that would be akin to cross-dressing or transsexuality. How would you describe to somebody the difference between being a male with feminine energy who is satisfied to just live life in a more male way, or in a not stereotypical, but a more feminine man presentation, versus being a male having feminine energy and wanting to take on more of a personification of being a woman? Does that make sense?
Kind of. Yeah. There's like people, both males and females, tend to have different levels of masculinity and femininity, and some males are more feminine, some females are more masculine. But I think there's a difference between how much someone like experiences, you know, maybe being a little gender atypical, but it's independent of their sexual orientation, you know, versus if you have this auto-heterosexuality, it creates a salient feeling of being the thing or being like the thing you want to be. In my book, I call this feeling, it's a mental shift. And that language is taken from the trans species subculture. They have feelings of being an animal at times. And basically, phenomenologically, what they describe is a very similar experience, but it's just animal stuff instead of gender stuff. And
you mean like Furbies?
Yeah, like Therians and Otherkin. like people that identify as animals or dragons or other kind of identity is really far out. Very interesting. But yeah, they have a temporary feeling of being the thing. And this seems to happen with all these types of autosexual trans identity, whether it's like trans species, trans race, you know, transgender. When you have the autosexual type of these types of trans, you can have an inner sensation of being the thing you identify as. And that is very gratifying. You're like in union with the thing you love. And so it's a very reinforcing feeling.
Fascinating.
When you talk about the political cover-up of auto-heterosexuality in your book, are you referencing the medical community? Do you think they're doing the covering up, the denial, or the mental health community?
I would say it's not like the mental health community per se, so much as the activist pressure that has been exerted on that community to make them yield to what the activists want. And certainly there are some clinicians that have an activist bent to them and contribute to this, but it's not, the cover-up was not a decision made by the clinicians per se. It was done under influence by autogynephilic transsexuals mostly. They're the principal ones that covered it up, you know, starting with what they did to Michael Bailey in 2003.
So you're saying that, are these self-identified?
No.
Auto. Okay. So you're...
I'm saying they are that, even though they don't think they're that.
Aha. And that's based on the literature or something they've put out, and they're describing their experience in the similar kind of term, something like that?
Yeah. Like, if you're familiar with how autogynephilia works and sort of how it feels and how the sort of structure of thinking associated with it, and then you read the things they've written, it's clear that what they're experiencing is autogynephilia. And the reason that a lot of people may not want to identify with this term is because it directly conflicts with to have that self-image of being the other gender. It directly conflicts with it, and so it can be upsetting to them.
Phil, I know nothing about Michael Bailey. At least I don't think I do. Can you tell us what happened?
Oh, yeah. And so this is one of the earliest online cancellation campaigns. A few transsexual women. Michael Bailey came out with a book. He's a researcher at Northwest University. He came out with a book that aims to popularize the two-type model of male-to-female transgenderism, in which one was homosexual and one was autogynephilic. Most of the book was just about the homosexual kind, because that's mostly what Bailey had studied at that point. But he included Ray Blanchard's research on autogynephilia. Autogynephilia is only mentioned in the last third of the book. It's really not the main focus of the book, but there's a few transsexual women who are in positions of power and prestige who worked together to try to exert any pressure they could on him. They defamed him. They made up so many lies about him and just tried to get him fired, you know, filed IRB complaints. They did every institutional method they could to twist his arm and suppress him and try to destroy him. And it silenced people. They learned that you should not talk about this. And ever since then, the transgender community has been pretty united in thinking that you should not talk about autogynephilia and that it's transphobic and hateful. And yet, as far as I can tell, at least like 80% of them are of that ideology, as far as the trans women go. And the last note on Bailey, he was basically exonerated completely. Alice Drager did a super intense investigation about the controversy surrounding the man who would be queen. It's a really good paper. It takes like almost an hour to read. It's basically half a book. And it just finds that basically he's didn't do anything wrong except tell true stuff that people didn't like.
I've gone halfway through it and it's like, wow. I had heard more about what had happened with Dr. Kenneth Zucker up in Canada. And I believe there's some overlap in the players involved. Not all, but I think there is some overlap in some of the individuals from within the trans community who also targeted Dr. Kenneth Zucker for his research.
It would be the same group of people, yeah. Because, yeah, Zucker was associated with CAMH, basically the gender clinic at University of Toronto, I think. And that's where the concept of autogynephilia was coined by Ray Blanchard. So basically anyone associated with that clinic is on the enemy list of the transgender movement.
We will take our first commercial break. We will be back shortly.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our commercial break. We are meeting with Phil Illy. Let's pick up where we left off.
That's where the concept of autogynephilia was coined by Ray Blanchard. So basically anyone associated with that clinic is on the enemy list of the transgender movement.
What they refer to as like fruit of the spoiled or rotten trees, something like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's interesting because coming up through the FTM community, right? That's colloquial language for those who are listening, female to male or trans man, trans male, trans masculine, some people use now. This is information that's less familiar, right? I don't know that there were too many trans men or FTMs involved in those efforts, at least not to the same degree as the ones that were leading the charge. And it's something that I didn't hear about until more recently. So I would imagine there are lots of listeners who are very unfamiliar. So I'm happy that you're sharing that. It's also very controversial. I'm a very heterodox individual myself, so I don't shy away from controversy. I like people to be able to read different accounts, make up their own decisions about things, check in, look up first sources of information. It's always helpful to be able to do that and not just make up our minds based on the title of an article or somebody who tweeted something out and just take that up as our own true opinion on things. Now, as controversial as autogynephilia or auto-heterosexuality and auto-androphilia, which is definitely not anything I had ever heard of until learning about your book. Not in the FTM communities have I ever heard anybody mention such a thing. So it's interesting. Are you positing that if autogynephilia, right, if auto-heterosexuality within natal males, if that's a correct way to say it in this particular conceptualization, yeah. Is this something you've heard people talk about, or is the assumption that if autogynephilia exists, there must also be autoandrophilia?
It's both. Originally, I didn't think autoandrophilia was a thing because that's what the leading sexologists have written and what they published and said. But then among the little subcultures of those of us online who read the sexology and have these orientations, there was a few autoandrophilic females there, and they said that they experienced it, and I talked to a few of them and asked them questions about their experience, and the responses they gave matched up with the idea that autoandrophilia does exist. And there's also like other signs that basically, like, if the most common cause of gender transition in males is attraction to being the other sex, then like it will at least be one of the causes for females, you know. And that female to male transsexuals, a lot of them, you'll hear them talk about gender euphoria, and you'll hear them talk about, quite a few of them experience phantom penis sensation, where particularly like in a sexual context, they might feel as if they have a penis and Like it's almost like a proprioceptive sensation. And there's these sort of phenomenological things that are also described by a lot of trans women. And I actually started putting more emphasis on these sort of sensations of gender euphoria and phantom anatomy after seeing that people with trans species identity had them too. And basically, yeah, it seems like a lot of this, the overall style of thinking and the sort of phenomenological things, there's a lot of overlap between, you know, FTMs and MTFs. And I've talked to autoandrophiles that say it's arousing to be a man. And so like all these little signs together point me to the conclusion that it's a major driver of female to male transgenderism. Autoandrophilia is. And it's even mentioned in that genderqueer book that people have been getting worked up about.
Oh, let's talk about that. So genderqueer, for those of you who are unfamiliar, this is a graphic novel, meaning it's like a comic book, so to speak. And it's, I think, is it situated, is the main character like a teenager or early 20s, somewhere around there? And I know that one of the controversies is that it's been showing up in public school libraries. I'm not sure what age range libraries, whether it's elementary or middle or high school. But I know that that's part of the controversy that I've been more familiar with, is it's a graphic novel, meaning it's cartoons, so to speak, but that it's also graphic in a gratuitous way. There's sexual depictions that make parents uncomfortable, I guess, depending on what grade level library this book is showing up in. But I learned recently there is reference to auto-heterosexuality and auto-androphilia in this book. And the confusion I have is there is immense support for genderqueer, the graphic novel, to be available to students in public school libraries. And at the same time, there's a lot of pushback and shutting down, even as you've talked about, on this concept of autogynephilia or auto-heterosexuality. So here's a book that's being endorsed by the community, sort of at large, for people who are not familiar with that. At least social media seems to be an at-large endorsement of the book, but it contains a topic matter that's not supposed to be endorsed. How is that happening?
My read on the situation is that Republicans in the U.S. and conservatives, they freaked out that there are a few pictures in there that could be seen as graphic, but it's honestly pretty tame. It's not really that big of a deal, in my opinion. But conservatives have freaked out that this is in schools. And so because conservatives say it's bad, that means the liberals and progressives have to say it's good. And, you know, they'll react and oppose whatever their enemy is doing. And so they're in full support of this book, which I think it's a pretty good resource for, like, if there's an autoandrophilic female that's having trouble making sense of their experiences, this book goes through the author's journey of trying to figure out their whole deal with gender, like trying to make sense of their experience. And my book is like about trying to help people like that understand their experience. So like, I like that this book is, that genderqueer is out there. And the author says in there, you know, on the page where they mention autoandrophilia, they mention they come across it, and the little thought bubble says something like, finally, a term for me, or something like that, like a term that describes me. And it's like a little moment of revelation for them. And the book, yeah, it talks about their sexuality, that, you know, like I said, their journey through trying to understand their experience. And it also very, very sympathetic portrayal of the gender dysphoria associated with it. So there's a lot of political contestation around it, but I think it's really pretty tame in the scheme of things. Kids have cell phones. So like a comic book that has like a few mild pictures of sexual depiction is like not that big of a deal.
Do you think the author of Gender Queer read your book or is familiar with your writings? I'm wondering where they even learned of the concept of.
Their book came out before mine. Yeah, mine just came out a month ago or so. I guess a couple months at this point. And yeah, no, they came across that concept on their own of autoandrophilia. You know, some people talk about it online, but it's not known about as much because it's not treated as a real thing in the scientific literature. that needs to be investigated and taken seriously. And so people who experience it, you know, if they don't do a deep dive, they might conclude, oh, this isn't real and that's not a thing, when it is actually a thing. And yeah, I think time will prove me right on this. I'm pretty confident in it.
You mentioned the depictions that I described as like gratuitously graphic as being not that big of a deal. I'm a very socially liberal person, but I was also raised Catholic. And so when I saw depictions of the images of like oral sex with a strap-on dildo, I clutched my pearls a little bit, to be honest. I wouldn't want my kids seeing. So even those of us who are quote unquote liberals, I think there are some limits when it comes to maybe my high school kid, but not my middle school or elementary school kid, just to put myself out there as
well. I'd agree that like high school, okay, but like younger than that, maybe not.
Yeah, because I know that with the computers in their pockets, kids are exposed to not graphic drawings. They're watching pornography on their phone. So I know that to be true as well. If one political party or if one side of the political aisle says it's bad, there's just going to be almost a knee-jerk response of, no, it's good, in order to counter it, even if people are not familiar. I think if you were to say, here's the depictions in the book, can I show this to your 10-year-old? They might be like, oh, wait, right? It's a little bit different when it's people are confronted with the realities of it, not just, oh, they think it's bad, so we think it's good. It's creating a false polarization there.
I think it's mostly the tribal influence that made it the progressive stand behind it.
Yeah, makes sense.
Do you actually get notified when your book is pulled? And I looked it up. I'm going to pull it up for just a second here. I went through some of the sections of the book, and what comes up is the illustrator, Maya Kobabi.
Yeah, for Genderqueer. That's the author and illustrator.
Okay. And you said your book came out last month. This is the book?
No.
This is different, right?
We're talking about Genderqueer by Maya Kobabi, which is not my book. My book is Auto-Heterosexual. And my book is like a textbook.
That's what I thought. So when you were saying, Xander, it was graphic, I was...
Genderqueer is a graphic novel. It's pictures. In the book Genderqueer, the concept of auto-androphilia is mentioned, which is a similar topic that's raised in Phil's book about auto-heterosexuality.
Are you aware if it raised eyebrows at all?
If what has raised eyebrows?
I mean, it's a textbook.
It hasn't gotten out there yet. The audience is building for it, but I spent all my time when I was writing it just writing it, not messing around on Twitter or trying to build an audience. Sure. So now I'm working on spreading it, and there's people that are really behind it and trying to help, so I think it'll continue to grow with its spread
now. Yeah. Since it's a textbook, you did a lot of research on what sexologists have been studying and writing about. Are you now in the position where you are speaking with sexologists and you're advocating, promoting your book? And what's been the response from sexologists who are teaching and training around the world? And have you had any opportunities to speak to students who are studying sexology as well?
I got reached out to by a professor that wanted me to talk to his class. I'll be doing that in the fall. And I'll be going to a sexology conference next month called the Puzzles of Sexual Orientation. And at that one, basically, a lot of the world's leading sexual orientation researchers will be there and just presenting to themselves. It's like a small gathering of the experts to try to advance knowledge and like basically share knowledge between the experts.
How did they become aware of you? Do you know? Did they let you know?
Oh, I've been in contact with Michael Bailey, and I also correspond with Kevin Sue, and they'll both be there. And they invited me to go there because I think they're curious to find out whether I'm saying autoandrophilia is real, and they're not currently on board with it, some of them. And so but since they're good scientists that are just basically looking for truth, they would want to know if they're wrong. And so I'm going to be there and present my argument for why we should take autoandrophilia's existence seriously and start looking for it.
Yeah, maybe doing some research on it specifically.
Exactly. Because, like, basically, if with the two type model, there's one type that's homosexual, and they're like so homosexual that they have severe gender nonconformity associated with it. So it'd be unlikely that they'd have any type of heterosexual attractions at all. And so that means that basically any trans person who has sexual attractions that are not strictly homosexual with respect to their birth sex, that means they're another type. And so when I look at the sexual orientations reported in studies, and particularly the large US transgender survey, I find that the vast majority of trans people report some amount of sexual attraction to the other sex. And this leads me to conclude that they are of a type that is not the homosexual type. And since we only know of this other type in males, it's autogynephilia is well established. In females, the scientific literature is not established, but the way they think and the phenomena they describe is there's a lot of overlap. And so it leads me to conclude that most cases of female to male transgenderism are ultimately of autoandrophilic ideology as well.
There's homosexual, heterosexuals, but there's also bisexuals, or what is now more commonly referred to by some as pansexual. So I wonder if there might be the development or the conceptualization of a third option here too. If you have the homosexual type and the heterosexual type, like I wonder how we could make sense of what would a bisexual or pansexual type look like.
So the way to think of it that Blanchard did in his papers is there's a type that has homosexual attractions and there's a type that has non-homosexual attractions. And that non-homosexual category includes heterosexuals, bisexuals, and asexuals. And according to the theory, the bisexual ones, they have this secondary attraction to having same-sex relations because it allows them to play like a cross-gender sex role. If an autogynephilic male is with a man, they can play a sex, like a female sex role. And if autoandrophilic female is with a woman, that autoandrophilic female can play a male sex role. And so a lot of them experience bisexual attractions. And as far as the asexuals go, that's explained by the theory as basically their autosexuality is just so much of their sexuality that there's just none left over for the conventional external attraction to people. And so they don't have attraction to other people. And they're some of the most strongly predisposed and likely to transition, I think.
Yeah, I'm wondering for On, as a sexologist, I'm curious, are these ideas that you encountered in your studies and with the individuals that you've worked with as autogonophilia, autoandrophilia, autoheterosexuality?
I know there have been some discussions at school. We have a program, Phil, where we train professionals as transgender therapists or transgender care professionals, depending on their background. I know that there is a lot covered in that. I personally have not met anyone, but I'm a bookworm, so my head is always entrenched in material. I teach hormones for adults, for instance, and then I teach another component for another segment of the program. So I'm always doing research and trying to keep up. Really haven't done much work. I'm not, by definition, sex therapist in the way people would see a sex therapist, someone who would sit down with a couple or an individual. I don't do any of that work. I got my training in it, but I prefer to study. That's my angle. And so I'm very open always to hearing other people's take, because I don't think I could possibly know it all. And when someone comes along and pokes at me about experience that they've had, I do like to explore that. I think that's very important to do.
Yeah, most of my time as a licensed clinical social worker, I was not doing psychotherapy. I was doing clinical case management. But for the few years that I did do psychotherapy, where I worked as a gender therapist and saw adult trans clients who were binary in their identification and presentation and transsexual in the style, they wanted to do medical transition. I don't recall encountering any like backstories or ideas that they were having in their own identification or in the process they were going through that would fit this idea of auto-heterosexuality, auto-gynophilia, or auto-androphilia. I mostly worked with FTMs, but I did have a couple of MTF clients. I'm wondering, though, if there are people who are having these internal feelings or drives, how likely do you think, Phil, are they to speak about it in a therapy session, given how much negativity there is surrounding the very concept? If people are willing to destroy the careers and lives of researchers, how likely is it that a person is going to want to disclose this information, fearing that they might be denied, quote, a letter for hormones or a letter for surgery, where that's still necessary in a lot of places around the world and in even within the United States to a certain degree?
We are going to take our second commercial break. We will be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our commercial break. Let's pick up where we left off.
If there are people who are having these internal feelings or drives, how likely do you think, Phil, are they to speak about it in a therapy session, given how much negativity there is surrounding the very concept? If people are willing to destroy the careers and lives of researchers, how likely is it that a person is going to want to disclose this information, fearing that they might be denied, quote, a letter for hormones or a letter for surgery, where that's still necessary in a lot of places around the world and in even within the United States to a certain degree?
Yeah, no, that's a very real thing that, well, like, first of all, a lot of them don't even realize a lot of the thoughts are ultimately the cause of a sexual orientation, because they're not always all sexual. There's sexual orientation changes our thinking in many subtle ways in everyday life that are not clearly a byproduct of sexuality. And secondly, if they do realize that there's a sexual underpinning to it, like you said, they'll be likely to not bring it up, either because there'll be shame, or, you know, shame's a big, big thing here. And there's also just feeling that it might invalidate them as a good candidate for the gender affirming care that they're looking for. And, you know, a lot of clinicians they might feel that it invalidates them. And when in reality, it solidifies that they are legitimately having the category of experience that's called gender dysphoria, like that they're legitimate in their transsexual feelings. But a lot of clinicians aren't hip to this, and so understandably, either because of shame or just wanting to make sure that they get the hormones and such that they're looking for, that they don't bring it up in therapy.
Have you heard it likened to addiction?
Yeah, I don't think it is, though, because it's one of the fundamental drives in life. You know, it's not like gambling or drugs where you can go without them. And while people can go without sexual expression, it tends to make them miserable if they don't meet their sexuality to some extent. So, I mean, I personally don't think of it as an addiction or a behavioral addiction, but some people have portrayed it that way.
One of the things I'm curious about, and as we're wrapping up here, is do you think there might be some concerns that auto-heterosexuality or auto-gynophilia or auto-androphilia may be more difficult to justify as being medically necessary care or life-saving care? Because I know when we talk about gender-affirming care, the justification is it's medically necessary, it's life-saving. Do you think that there's a fear that auto-heterosexuality somehow undermines that legitimacy as being medically necessary and therefore life-saving?
Right. Yeah. There's also that fear that the consequences of this information being known could jeopardize access to medical care that transsexuals want. And that is a justifiable fear, but I don't think that justifies covering up knowledge of this, because only a subset of people that experience these feelings decide to transition. And they're doing so without understanding why they even want it in the first place. And I think that does not maximize well-being. I think if people understand what they want and why they want it, that they'll make better decisions for themselves, whether that's transition or otherwise.
So there's quite possibly, I think you're saying there is a lack of insight into this being something that somebody's actually experiencing. Which is that because there's just so much information out there? I would imagine people are really confused, right? They go to the internet, they go to discussion or support groups, they go into places like Reddit and wherever else people are going to get their information. And there's so much information. Some of it is very conflicting. And I would imagine people are confused as to how to sift through all of the information that's out there. And so now this is like one more thing that's getting added on to that more conflicted or even convoluted, really complicated matrix of our identities.
Yeah, that's real, that there's kind of an abundance of information. It can be overwhelming and it's hard to know what's true, which is why I included all of it in the book, so that people can just read one thing and then understand their condition.
This has been really informative, Phil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. One more time for people. Let me say the title of the book. It's Auto-Heterosexual: Attracted to Being the Other Sex. I mean, I've got to tell you, it raises some curiosity for me. I'm like, oh, what type am I? You know, I'm not one to really type myself. And when I don't want to know the answers to a lot of things, I like a lot of the idea of not knowing things. I can see that there's a bunch of different kinds of clouds in the sky, and I know they all have different names, but I really don't want to know. I just like marveling at the clouds. I'm more mystical in that way. And so I hold a similar idea about sexuality and sexual orientation and gender identity and gender expression. I don't really want to know all that stuff. Like, let's just do our thing and have people leave us alone for the most part. But I'm fascinated by the fact that you did have a question about it. You went out and did the research about it. You wrote a book about it, and congratulations. I know that writing a book is not an easy thing to do. So I hope that people are interested enough that they will go out and buy the book. Is this something that people could just go onto Amazon and buy? It's readily available.
Yeah, they can find it on Amazon. I've also uploaded it to a pirate library that doesn't need to be named, but people that know where to find it. And they can also find me on Twitter. I've posted most of the book on there. And I've also been posting parts of the book on my Substack as well.
Fantastic. When this episode goes live, we will have information like your Twitter handle so that people can access that directly as well. Again, on set it, I'll repeat it. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We tend to say to people, if not always, we'd love to have you back, because I think there's so much you've covered that we could go in so many different directions, because I think we just scratched the surface on auto-heterosexuality. I think this is something that deserves an entire next show. So we'd like to formally invite you to come back and go in more depth with us.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Just let me know.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Phil. That wraps up our program for this hour. Next time, when you tune into the Umbrella Hour, we will have a guest, Parker Geith. I think that's how we pronounce his name. I'm sure this person will correct us once we meet them in person. You all have a good rest of your day, night, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for listening.